the military plans kept expanding to the point that they were going to have fleets of B-52s dropping bombs on Damascus and other areas where other government strongholds. So basically, the plan was to destroy the Syrian government's military and intelligence capacities.
That's Robert Perry of the Consortium News. I got to go. Thanks to Robert for donating and becoming a member of WEFT. You can still do it. It's time for the Labor Hour again. Fighting for 15 this afternoon at 2 o'clock. Ricky Baldwin, Pat Simpson, and Belden Fields. Check it out if you want to hear some straight talk about what the so-called minimum wage really ought to be, it seems to me. Thanks for listening. It's past time for the Labor Hour. 359-9338.
We're just not working anymore. Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air by listeners supported the community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois, broadcasting 90.1 FM and webcasting live worldwide at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Bob with some of our underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, give them a call at 217-328-2295. And programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber. He believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour and also the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Thank you, Bob. And if you haven't already known about this, we're in Pledge Drive, which means twice a year we have to try to get listeners like you call in and to give us whatever you can afford to help keep us on the air, because WFT has very unique programming, very unique public affairs shows like the World Labor Hour, Higher Ground, News from Neptune, and a whole host of others here, as well as some very unique musical genres that you will not hear on corporate radio. And we got some interesting gifts for you if you do call in. For listeners of Public Affairs Program WFT, we have special thank you gifts, and they're for a pledge of $100. With the phone, you can receive a copy of the DVD Dispatches 02, produced by Rick Rowley and Jeremy Scahill. A special offer will last only as long as we have the DVDs on hand, so don't delay. So give us a call right now at 217-359-9338 and reserve your copy. And also what we have is Robert McChesney's media activist, who's a media activist and scholar, has provided some of his latest books for WFT to give supporters. For a donation of at the $120 level or more, you can choose between his book Dollarocracy, a major work of the political economy of media, or Digital Disconnect, Professor McChesney's analysis of corporate influence on the internet. So please call now and support public affairs broadcasting and get your choice of these stimulating books for a pledge of $120 or more. And to receive this special premium, you must call during this hour and make your pledge. So the phone number again is area code 217-359-9338. Okay.
Our standard pledge premium levels also still are in existence besides those special ones during the public affairs program. So you can become a member at $40, like you said, and take the Airshifter training, get your own show here. At $65, you get one pledge premium. At $90.10, you get two thank you gifts. And at $120, you can get three thank you gifts. And those include T-shirts, baseball caps, and tote bags. But like you say, during the public affairs programs, we got these really special ones here, the DVDs and the books by Robert McChesney.
Yes, and at $40, you can not only have your own show, but you can also vote as far as station policy and for members of the board. It's a very, it's quite a bargain, actually. You can be part of the station here for just $40 a month.
Yeah. $40 for a whole
year. I'm sorry,
$40
for the whole year.
And
what
really,
am I saying? Yes, $40 for the whole year. I mean, that's really incredible.
But when you think at it on a monthly basis, like you say, it's only like $3.33
some
a
change.
Month or something.
Yeah,
you know, that's like one cup of coffee or something like that, you know.
Yes, indeed.
And, that Airshifter training is really interesting. People take that just to learn about community radio, about FCC regulations, and about the station in general. You don't even have to become an Airshifter. It's just an interesting course to take. And you can also get some studio training here about some of the equipment around here. It's, I think most people would just enjoy taking that course.
And, yes.
You know,
so. And it's relatively painless. I mean, what is it, a couple evenings for 2-3 hours?
Yeah, a couple evenings for less than 2 hours, mm-hmm. I think, you know. And second class FCC class is even shorter than that, an hour or something like that. And
okay.
Then you can come in here to the studio and get some training on the equipment. It's fascinating how radio actually works,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Indeed. So. Okay, Bob, so we got a few news. Oh, we have a caller calling in, Dr. Judy Desovich. She's calling from Springfield, Missouri. She was one of the physicians, along with Margaret Flowers and about 100 other people, who were arrested at the so-called public health care hearings in the U.S. Senate back in 2009. And she'll be calling in to talk about the Affordable Care Act as well as Medicare for All. So stay tuned for that at 6:30. So now we'll go to some news stories. And, Bob, what do you have for us this morning?
I got an interesting story here. I read this. It just made me cringe to think of how corporate America tries to treat their employees and stuff, you know. And this is out of the New York area. The headline of the story is Big Brown Waves the White Flag. It says, in the wake of a relentless grassroots labor community solidarity campaign, UPS waved the white flag and agreed to rehire all 250 New York City drivers the company fired last month. The campaign united drivers, elected officials, and even UPS customers. UPS issued termination notices to 250 drivers in March for a 90-minute work stoppage they had carried out on February 26th. Yaro Reyes, a 24-year-old driver, had been fired for starting work too early and was walked off the job. This violated the Teamsters contract, which called for a 72-hour waiting period and a hearing before a worker could be walked off. So drivers gathered in the parking lot to show their displeasure. Our contract had been violated so many times, Reyes told Labor Notes. This was the straw that broke the camel's back. So Reyes is one of the drivers who will return to work under the terms of the agreement struck between UPS and Teamsters Local apparently on Wednesday of this week. UPS had previously vowed never to back down. The company refused to negotiate with Local 804 and told the press it would boot all 250 drivers as soon as replacements were trained. At first, management seemed to make good on the threat. The first 20 workers were fired on March 31st. At the end of their last workday of the month, so that they and their families would lose their April health care coverage.
Oh, man.
I mean, how can a corporation think that they're doing good for the people of this country and the workers and the families? I mean, 4 days later, UPS fired 16 more drivers as their local president prepared to take the stage to speak at the Labor Notes conference. But just 5 days after that, UPS executives from company headquarters in Atlanta were at the table and striking an agreement with the union to return all 250 drivers to work, you know. So it says, what made Brown back down? Immediately after the walkout, Local 804 leaders met with the company to try to settle the dispute. Managers shut down the talks after minutes and said they were issuing termination notices to all 250 drivers. So Local 804 launched a grassroots campaign to mobilize public support. First, the union mobilized its own ranks. Stewards and union activists passed out bulletins and petitions. But the outreach quickly spread to the public in the form of an online petition launched by working family parties. That's a political party in New York State, right?
Kind of, sort of, yes.
It's a grassroots political party of affiliated unions and community groups, including Teamsters Joint Council 16 in New York. So Local 804 members rallied on March 21st in front of the UPS hub in Queens and delivered more than 105,000 petition signatures to the company. There was a moderate Democrat he was an assembly member, city assembly member, Michael Szymanowicz, says he's no labor radical. He was a UPS customer. His UPS driver, Dominic Dedham D'Domenico, was one of the 250 fired Teamsters, but this guy had a special backstory. Dedham was run over while delivering Christmas packages for UPS.
What?
He spent 10 days in a coma and another 13 months recovering from traumatic brain injury.
Unbelievable.
And now get this. When Dedham returned to UPS, he was met with a barrage of warning letters and suspensions for failing to meet his previous demonstrated performance. A supervisor assigned to monitor Dedham for a day reported that customers were slowing him down to welcoming him back to the job and breaking into tears. That's why he was taking so much time and he wasn't able to do what he had done previously.
Wow.
But they fired this guy. Management responded by suspending Dedham and telling him to pick up the pace. Brown's ultimatum: deliver one more package per hour or lose your job. Then Dedham became one of the 250 who were issued termination notices. So he spent a week in a coma, and how does the company repay him when he comes back to work? They fire him because he stood up for his brother, says Szymanowicz. This is not over. Dedham is not fired. If he is, then I'll personally lay down in front of that driveway. This is a city council member in New York saying this.
You know? I'm telling you, I mean, the class war, it's here if you haven't realized it, and it's intensifying. So, you know, the way I look at it, if these companies want to act like that, if they want to basically pretty much wipe their butts with any kind of social contract, then why should we honor anything? Why should we be good to them? I mean, we, you know, they want to make our lives hell, we should turn around and make their lives hell.
A hot campaign got hotter. You know, elected officials began scrutinizing UPS's financial dealings with the city and state, including a sweetheart, including a sweetheart deal through the Department of Finance's stipulated fine program that cut UPS's parking tickets by $15 to $20 million a year. So all of a sudden, UPS responded by firing 20 drivers chosen at random. You know, Local 804 kicked its campaign up a notch. You know, the union reached out to the press, yada yada. They go on, talked about this driver Dedham and stuff like that. Drivers told their story, flanked by more than a dozen elected officials and stuff. They say, I do not understand who at that company put forward a business plan that takes away a generation of goodwill between UPS and the city of New York, a lady says. But this is not going to end this way. UPS acts 16 more drivers the following day. So it says, with political pressure and bad PR on the rise, UPS tried to justify the firings as the only responsible business decision. We simply cannot allow employee misconduct that jeopardizes our ability to reliably serve our customers, UPS. So the union decided to put the question directly to the customers. They launched this thing, you know. Anyway, they flooded the Facebook page. They got all of these petitions going and stuff like that. And, you know, they talked about some of these other people that were drivers. They went out and they got their customers. And so the people, the customers were saying, what can Brown do for me? They can give me my driver back. You know, this was the UPS customers and everything. So eventually, they ended up backing down and rehiring these 250 drivers. Mm-hmm. But it's just a slap in the face to these workers, you know, that they would continue to do this, you know.
That is just an incredible story. You could almost make a short mini-series on this.
There's more in here that, you know, but in the essence of speed or whatnot, I had to leave parts of it out. But I was reading that. That's on Labor Notes, which you should mention again that you went to that conference.
Yes, indeed. Week. Yeah, very good conference. And that's incredible about the guy getting fire news and Labor Notes.
Interesting stuff. So indeed. But they did finally back down and rehire the 250 drivers, and they changed that to a 10-day suspension. But anyway, it's just amazing.
You know, it's just that, you know, even looking at this from the company's point of view, or, you know, from a corporate point of view, let me put it this way, that's stupid. I mean, what are they going to gain, you know? I mean, unbelievable.
Yes.
Anyway, I guess I got this from the National Committee to Preserve and Protect Social Security and Medicare. Government overpayments to private insurers and Medicare Advantage is bad policy and bad economics for the Medicare program. These subsidies were supposed to be gradually trimmed in order to expand benefits and improve the quality of care for all seniors in Medicare. However, each year the insurance lobby threatens to cancel coverage or charge more to seniors in the Medicare Advantage plans rather than accept a reduction in their overpayments or reimbursement rates. For many years, private insurance companies have claimed they can provide better coverage to seniors at a lower cost than the government can directly. The reality proves otherwise. Since 2003, all seniors in Medicare, including those not even enrolled in Medicare Advantage, have paid higher premiums to help fund the billions in government overpayments to private medical Advantage insurance companies. Over the years, as much as 14% more per beneficiary has been paid to Medicare Advantage plans as paid to cover individuals enrolled in traditional Medicare. It's a wasteful federal boondoggle that was rightfully corrected by a passage of the and then it goes on. Let's be clear, contrary to the health insurance industry's massive lobbying campaign claims, Medicare doesn't make the decision about cuts to seniors. Medicare Advantage coverage, including increasing premiums or reducing access to doctors, that decision rests squarely in the boardrooms of the nation's private insurance industry, which is unwilling to give up a penny of their government giveaway in favor of continued threats of diminished coverage and higher premiums for seniors. I mean, this is ridiculous. You know, why do you give money to a private company that's going to provide, you know, an inferior service? In fact, it's a service that's not even needed, you know?
Yeah.
Amazing.
It is amazing. Want to hear some more amazing
Yes,
news?
Indeed. Let's go, Bob.
We've talked several times on this program about the $8.7 billion that the state of Washington was given to
Yes.
Boeing Company, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is how Boeing is paying them back, you know. Boeing is moving 1,000 more engineering jobs to California.
Oh, I mean,
Boeing will transfer.
What call? What call?
Yeah, Boeing will transfer another 1,000 engineering jobs from its Puget Sound area to Southern California by the end of next year. Engineering head Mike Delaney said Boeing still intends to make this region a true world-class composite center for advanced manufacturing design. So since last spring, Boeing has announced the move of more than 4,300 white-collar jobs from the Puget Sound region. Here's an example. March of 2013, IT engineering moved to Missouri and South Carolina, took 1,500 jobs with them, you know. Also, May of 2013, out-of-production airplane support left for California, with taking 300 jobs with them, you know. December of 2013, Boeing Research and Technology moved to Alabama, California, Missouri, and South Carolina. Another 1,000 jobs went away. April of 2014, this in-production airplane support to California took 1,000 jobs, you know. The move has been rumored for months. It's the latest in the series, like I say, that totals more than 4,300 Boeing jobs, you know, out of the area. It's the latest blow. Most of the engineering group that provides technical support to airplanes flying Boeing jets will move to Seal Beach and to Long Beach in California. Even the operations center in Tukwila, where a team is on call 24/7 to respond to any technical issue with a Boeing airplane anywhere in the world, will move to California. So now these are administrative jobs, engineering jobs. They're not part of the settlement with the union up there to keep mm-hmm. the jobs, the manufacturing jobs at the plant up there.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, the governor of Washington State was, you know, promoting the $8.7 billion bailout. And they got the Society for Professional Engineering Employees in Aerospace, which is the SPEEA. And it says the SPEEA specifically warned Governor Inslee that his legislation was crafted with loopholes that would allow Boeing to take the $9 billion and outsource jobs anywhere. A gentleman says, why doesn't the governor call a special session to close the loopholes and save these jobs? Inslee, the governor, said Boeing's decision is obviously disappointing.
Oh my God.
He added that he welcomed hearing
it's Boeing. Obviously disappointing.
Yeah, Boeing, he welcomed hearing Boeing reiterated his commitment today to keep a robust core of engineering work here, you know. It's like, how can you be such,
Well, he's paid off. I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not stupid. I mean,
well,
he's going to get
I was going to ask that question.
He's paid off. Of course he is. You know?
You give him that big bailout and stuff to keep the manufacturing jobs there, but
yeah.
you don't realize that they're going to continue to move every other job out of there that they can. You know, it's just,
yep.
And it's another instance of how these corporations don't have any respect for the workers, the people, or the government of
right.
the state. They don't even care what the governor and the state did for them, giving
yeah.
them that big money.
Let the workers occupy their plant and see how fast they're calling up the governor to want the National Guard and the local SWAT teams to come in, though.
And
you know, that's the thing. They take, you know.
Yeah, it's just amazing how these corporations get away with this stuff, you
mm-hmm.
know, and I don't know. Amazing to read these kind of stories.
Well, because the politicians like keep giving them the money. That's
yes.
the problem, you know.
Yes.
Look here, even in Champaign, Illinois. I mean,
yeah,
we could talk about
that warehouse out there on Mattis Avenue, south of the Kraft.
Yeah. And the hotel downtown here. I mean, the hotel especially.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what? They're not coming here because of a subs. They're coming here because there's a market. Because there's
yeah.
a huge downtown nightlife center here, and there's all sorts of events going on all the time. You know, football, basketball,
yeah.
what have you.
Yeah.
They're going to come here anyway. But, of course, you know they can just come in and, you know, do a little song and dance and, you know, say, well, we're going to provide this many jobs. $100,000, and you know, then they just fork the money over. You know, meanwhile, are they talking about reducing hours at the Champaign Public Library?
Yeah, yeah. Somebody's got to pay the taxes, Dave. You know, I mean, and I know everybody out there says, you know, no more taxes for me. I'm a taxpayer, you know, and, you know, but the roads are tore up and stuff. So if the people ain't paying the taxes, we don't want to pay them, and the corporations ain't paying the taxes, then I don't know who's going to build a road ever, you know?
Well, you know, I think Bill's talked about this in the show before. You go back to the 1950s and 60s, and you look at what percentage of the overall taxes that were paid by corporations. It was something like around 40%.
Right.
And
right.
Now it's down to less than 10%,
right,
you know?
Right. You know, so
do the math, people.
It's coming down on the heads of you and me,
that's
the people
right
out there.
That's,
you know,
right.
And, you know, we all cry. We don't want to pay them taxes.
You know? Well, most of us can't. You know, we can barely afford it with our property taxes and what have you. You know, sales tax, which is, you know, affects poor and working people more, you know. It's because these freeloaders, these corporations, and these wealthy people are getting a free, you know, pretty much a free ride, you know. Then they take all sorts of tax subsidies, corporate welfare, and other kind of tax
breaks. Make a tax incremental district and stuff like that, TIF districts and things, you know. In the meantime, the price of groceries and gas is skyrocketing, and that's hurting you and me.
That's,
you
know, right. That's right.
How they can have inflation, and then they say core inflation, excluding food and energy, right?
Yeah, yeah,
how
yeah.
They figure,
well, that's where the inflation is.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, they you know,
those are the two things everybody has to have, you know, a warm place to live and, you know, and food.
What's the old saying? Figures don't lie, but liars can figure.
There yes. you go.
I think that's very appropriate for that. Anyway, this is from a blogger who's a retired IEA school teacher. He talks about what happened in Chicago here this last week. The fast passage of Senate Bill 1922 was a bipartisan affair. It was introduced yesterday morning. Let's see, he sent this out on, when was it here? Oh, anyway, last week, with no hearing or debate, it was passed by the Illinois House and Senate by sundown. SB 1922 robbed the pensions of Chicago municipal employees and set the stage for the pension theft of Chicago cops, firemen, and teachers. As long as they thought that they would not be blamed for the property tax increase, the thieves in the Illinois General Assembly were willing to pass it and give the mayor and city council the credit for shafting working-class homeowners, which includes the pension members themselves. It didn't solve the problem, of course. It's all show and no substance. And what did he calls him Squeezy. He's talking about Quinn. I don't know where he got that nickname. But anyway, what will Quinn do? Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis is telling the governor not to sign it. But Quinn signed a Senate Bill 1 and a similar bill cutting park district pensions. But he wasn't running for governor, promising no increase in property taxes at that time. His signature on a bill that steals more pensions and will lead to increased Chicago property taxes will win him no votes. As usual, Bruce Rayner is silent on the issue, willing to let Quinn squirm. Note that many Republicans in the House were willing to shed their self-proclaimed aversion to raising taxes, so long as it wasn't taxes on their 1% patrons. The opportunity to screw city janitors and school cooks and other low-paid municipal workers was just too much for them to pass up. And he goes on to say, my state representative, Tony Berrios, voted for the pension theft. We just defeated Berrios when challenged by our candidate, Will Guzzardi. Anyway, her current lame duck representative tried to immunize herself on the pension issue by voting against Senate Bill 1 in December. But Guzzardi made her previous pension thievery a central part of his campaign, and Berrios returned to vote in form. So I think our caller is calling in right now. Hello, you're on the air. Who am I speaking to?
Hello.
Yes?
This is Judy Daskovitz. I'm a retired internal medicine physician from Springfield, Missouri.
Okay, Judy. Well, thank you so much for calling into the World Labor Hour. And, you know, we're having a semi-regular series here on healthcare because this is such a, it's an issue that affects almost every working person out there for sure, you know. And I think it's an issue that, you know, is not going to go away. I mean, of course, a lot of, you know, the corporate media and a lot of some average people out there are given the impression that the Affordable Care Act fixed the entire healthcare problem here in the United States. What's your view on that?
Well, I only wish that were true.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the reforms provided by the Affordable Care Act, too many people will remain without health insurance. Nationally, we had 50 million uninsured citizens prior to the Affordable Care Act, the ACA. If all 50 states expand Medicaid, and only about 25 have so far, we'll still have 25 million uninsured. That's the best case scenario.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And also, of the 25 million that are now insured, you know, there's also, you know, a big difference, in my opinion, you agree with me or not, between having health insurance and having adequate health care.
Absolutely. Having health insurance does not necessarily mean that you are, number one, able to afford it, or number two, able to access it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't, here in my state of Missouri, the legislator is adamant that they will not expand Medicaid.
Hmm.
Now, Medicaid is poor insurance for poor people.
Mm-hmm.
Medicaid does not have a constituency. A lot of doctors won't take it because it either doesn't cover their overhead or barely does. So I understand why it's hard to access Medicaid, but it's still better than nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you have Medicaid, you may not be able to find a doctor. You may have a spend down, which is essentially a deductible. That for somebody who has no money, that makes access an issue. Even if you have private health insurance, the supposedly good type, your deductible may be high, your copays may be high, your out-of-pocket expenses may be high, it may not cover drugs. There's all sorts of reasons why simply having an insurance isn't enough. As a matter of fact, there was a report that just out of Massachusetts from the Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation of Massachusetts, I believe Robert Wood Johnson Foundation was also in on this study, that looked at what's happening in Massachusetts. As you probably know, the health reforms instituted by Governor Romney are what the Affordable Care Act was patterned after. In Massachusetts, however, there are actually better consumer protections against the out-of-pocket expenses and the other expenses that keep people from using their health insurance. And what they found was that about 42% of people in this study said that these are insured people not of Medicare age, non-elderly people who are insured, that 42% of those people stated that they had problems because of medical bills, that it was a problem for their family. They put off, they had to use money that would have gone to education or other family expenses for health care. They put off health care because they couldn't afford it, even though they had insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, being in the upper middle class did not protect you. 30% of people who are considered wealthy, or at least not in the lower middle class or below, also stated that they had problems
mm-hmm.
with finances due to medical costs.
And that's still the highest cause of bankruptcy, I believe, is medical expenses. Is that correct?
Yes, that's mm-hmm. correct. About half of bankruptcies, according to a study done by David Himmelstein and Stephanie Wohlhandler from Harvard, about 50% of bankruptcies are due to medical costs, and most of those people had insurance when they started.
Mm-hmm. You know, so
insurance does not protect you from financial ruin.
Yes. I'm just looking at you know, a little talk you gave, I believe it was in your home state of Missouri, and you're saying here that health care needs to be for patients, not for profit. The Affordable Care Act does not rid health care of the profit motive. Private insurance companies, the pharmaceutical industry, and medical device makers are still making huge profits while patients are burdened with high premiums, high deductibles, high copays, and high drug costs. The CEO of your insurance company, you said, Coventry, makes $13 million a year, or in other words, $50,000 per day. Meanwhile, people die. Because we ration health care in the United States by ability to pay. And under the Affordable Care Act, we still can't choose our own doctors or hospitals because private insurance companies won't let us. Americans pay more out of pocket than citizens of other industrialized countries with universal health care. We spend much more per patient than those other countries, but our outcomes are worse. We have higher infant mortality, higher maternal mortality, and overall mortality, and fewer years lived in a healthy state. And, you know, I know, here's the thing, a lot of people out there, you know, the vast majority of the American people, over time has realized this, because, you know, of course, the corporate media in this country tries to, they don't want to talk about the healthcare systems in other countries very much, unless, of course, they can try to find something to criticize about it. But let me, this is all leading into a question here, is the big disagreement amongst people that I know, anyway, in my town, and I think nationwide, is that, is the Affordable Care Act a stepping stone in the right direction, or was it a diversion to distract from getting Medicare for all? That's a big question here.
I think it is exactly the opposite.
Of what? Exactly?
Well, I've been a fan for many years, an advocate of something called single-payer healthcare financing.
Yeah, which is Medicare for all, basically, correct?
Improved Medicare for all.
Mm-hmm.
Improved meaning things like it includes things that are not currently covered, like dental care and long-term care, and improved in that you don't have to buy a private supplemental policy for the 20% that Medicare doesn't cover. So first dollar coverage, and covers all health care needs. So far from being a stepping stone towards the system that other countries have, where they have better medical results and cheaper costs, it is actually a step towards total privatization. What the private insurance companies want, and they helped write this bill, is total privatization of Medicare and Medicaid, and they're on their way.
Yes, and so I guess the thing is that, what do you think is going to have to happen before people start, demanding Medicare for all? Because, you know, of course, again, you know, the corporate media, you know, even on the so-called liberal TV programs and stuff, you rarely hear even Medicare for all single payer mentioned, you know. I know it slips out once in a while. And like on Bill Maurer, I watched an episode a while back, and it happened to slip out, and the audience applauded big time when somebody on the panel mentioned Medicare for all. I mean, and of course, there was the famous in 2008 when Hillary Clinton was running the Democratic primaries for president. There was that famous question from the woman in the audience of Hillary Clinton about Medicare for all. And she goes, "Well, I know you all support it, but it's just not politically possible." You know, and of course, my question is, what do you mean exactly by that politically possible? Not politically possible if the vast majority of the American people support it.
Correct.
So I guess
that is the irony, is that the vast majority, I shouldn't say the vast majority, but a majority of people do support Medicare for all, and that includes doctors, and that's been changing rapidly as doctors have to spend more and more of their overhead on dealing with private insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a lot of support among citizens, and again, that includes medical people. And it's a nonpartisan support, but there's bipartisan opposition in Congress because the lobbyists for the insurance company and the device makers and the pharmaceutical industry spread their largesse among both parties. And so the politicians stand to lose. They won't get nearly the type of lobbying money that they're getting now. And they're very afraid that the word is going to get out, and I think that's why it's important to talk about it in every venue and every way we can. And I appreciate your willingness to talk to me on your show about this.
Mm-hmm.
I think advocacy and education is the key.
What do you think it's going to take, I mean, to start to, how should I say, at least get the ball rolling, to sort of start turning up the heat?
You know, I sort of facetiously say, although it's not exactly sarcasm, the studies, the graph shows that if you pit wages against rising health care insurance premiums, that it will take 100% of the average income to pay the health insurance costs in 2025. So I would say that at the very least, we're going to come to a crisis in 2025 where people have to use all of the average person has to use all their income to pay for health care costs. Obviously, the road we're on is not sustainable. And that's another problem with the Affordable Care Act, is it simply doesn't do anything to control costs.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure you're familiar with it. There's going to be a national Medicare for All day of action. I think it's on May 22nd. Are you you're familiar with this?
That's correct. Yes,
okay.
It is May 22nd, and I am familiar with it.
Okay. Do you what do you think? What do you think needs to be done? I mean, do you think people? Of course, there's a lot of different choices here, I guess. One would be going door to door, and trying to get petitions passed for ballot initiatives in states. But in addition to the education, and advocacy, demonstrations out in front of Congress people's offices. I mean, do you think these are tactics that should be pursued? What do you think maybe the focus should be? And then, of course, there's the other strategy, which is that do we try for a state-by-state basis?
Well, I think the answer is all of the above.
Okay.
I think just like a mountain can be worn down by water over time, every drop helps.
Mm-hmm.
Every person with a tiny little hammer and a tiny little nail can put a crack in the monolith, and eventually the monolith will shatter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not in the business of predicting when that's going to happen. I know it won't happen at all if we don't continue in our advocacy efforts. I absolutely think that the state-by-state approach is a very exciting possibility, with Vermont, of course, being the leaders in that.
Mm-hmm.
They are instituting a Medicare for All type financing system in 2017. The reason why they're not doing it sooner is because federal law prohibits them from doing it prior to that.
In fact, a provision in the Affordable Care Act prohibits them, correct?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Yes, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, and what I was going to say is that right off the bat, in 2009, right after President Obama was elected, we knew as single-payer advocates that there would be an attempt to reform health care, and we called our legislators, we faxed, we wrote letters, we visited people, but Max Baucus said up front in public, single-payer advocates are not invited to the table. We want a roundtable discussion. We want to hear everybody's opinion except for the single-payer people.
That's Democratic Senator Max Baucus of Montana, correct?
That is correct.
Who just got a? I guess he just got appointed as ambassador to China, I believe, didn't he?
I'm not aware of that, but
okay.
it doesn't surprise me.
Yes, indeed. Now, yeah. From what I understand, I mean, it was single payer advocates like the National Nurses Union, the steel workers, a lot of other groups it wasn't like they just showed up at the hearing one day. I mean, like you were mentioning, you called, you sent faxes, you made personal visits and stuff, and there was a concerted, calculated attempt to allow only corporate health insurance lobbyists to testify and to bar and prevent anyone from talking other than corporate lobbyists for anyone to talk about Medicare for All. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Uh-huh.
And we offered national experts with stellar credentials. Just one person. All we wanted was one person
mm-hmm.
to be on that panel representing the single payer point of view, and that simply was not allowed.
Mm-hmm. So the fix was from the get-go.
Being, mm-hmm. It is being suppressed. There's no question in my mind that the information about single payer is being suppressed, because once people hear it, and again, I'm talking people from the entire political spectrum in a nonpartisan way say, yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't we doing that?
Indeed. I just came back from the Labor Notes Conference in Chicago, and there was a couple workshops there on healthcare. One was union bargaining under Obamacare, of course, which is adversely affecting, construction industry unions. I'm a retired carpenter, with their healthcare plans, because they've had self-administered healthcare plans for all decades, and under the Affordable Care Act, they're eventually going to be facing 40% tax rate penalties for having their own healthcare systems.
Wow.
But anyway,
wow.
What surprised me, I mean, so there you go. I mean, you see what the intent was here. It wasn't to help people to get health insurance. The intent was to expand and solidify more the private health insurance industry.
Exactly.
Absolutely. And the irony is that the self-insurers, I want to talk about overhead costs for a minute here, because, single payer is not only the humane thing to do, it's inhumane, it's morally corrupt to allow our fellow citizens to die because they need health care but they can't afford it. But beyond that, we also have values as Americans of wanting to conserve money and spend it wisely.
Mm-hmm.
30 cents on the dollar spent administering private health insurance and allowing people to profit in a really egregious way is not the American way. It's economically insane. It's morally repugnant.
It's less than 3% for under Medicare. Is that correct?
For traditional Medicare, it's for traditional Medicare, not Medicare Advantage plans.
Yes.
But for traditional Medicare, the overhead is less than 3%.
Mm-hmm.
If you take all private health insurance companies, the overhead is 14%. So it's a difference of 12%.
Mm-hmm.
Or 11%. The irony is the self-insured plans, like you were talking about with the carpenters,
mm-hmm,
union, those are what bring the number down because they are much leaner. They don't tend to work on a profit motive.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take out the self-insured people, like you were talking about, the overhead is really more like 20 to 25%.
Wow.
That's certainly what it is at the Aetnas and the Blue Crosses of the world.
Mm-hmm. So. You know, what also surprised me at Labor Notes was that there was one workshop in which they had a young woman from Vermont who talked about, what they did in Vermont. But I was really surprised to hear panelists talk about that there's New York State is actually getting real close to having a similar plan enacted, like Vermont, and Maine is not too far behind. And also, I guess, Oregon, Washington, and California are also out there pushing as well. So, I mean,
California had a bill that was passed in both chambers,
mm-hmm,
but Schwarzenegger vetoed it.
But Terminator terminated the bill,
yeah,
yes.
He did, absolutely. And in Massachusetts, John Berwick, who used to be head of Medicare and Medicaid services, is running for governor, and part of his platform is single payer.
Oh, interesting.
So yes. So I do think the state by state approach is where it might come from.
Okay. Now the only concern I have, for a state by state approach, I mean, first of all, I'm convinced that's the only way it's going to happen because of the tremendous amount of money, of influence and money of lobbyists in Washington, D.C. But, you know, the problem I see with states enacting it, you know, one at a time sort of piecemeal, is we're going to have all sorts of healthcare refugees coming into from neighboring states. Like, for instance, Illinois, if we'd pass it, we'd be having tons of people come in from Indiana, Kentucky, and other states, you know. I mean, that I see as a potential problem. And, I mean, man, what a potential problem that is in the sense that, you know, you'd have to turn people away that desperately need care, you know.
I agree. It's not ideal.
Yes.
But it is a way. That's
mm-hmm.
how it started in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
The poorest, most rural province, arguably the one with the least power, Saskatchewan, decided that this is the route they needed to take, so it started provincially
mm-hmm.
and quickly spread to the rest of the country once they saw the advantages. And Canada was arguably more conservative at that time than the United States is even now.
Yes. Well, Judy, thank you so much for calling in. And, you know, like I say, we're talking about this healthcare issue on a semi-regular basis. So, you know, maybe we can have you back on the show sometime in the future. And hopefully we'll have some good news to talk about maybe, you know, down the road here in the 6 months or so.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye now.
Okay.
Yeah, Dave, and just to follow up, yeah, Max Baucus was confirmed as ambassador to China.
He got his payoff.
Yeah. Confirmed 96-0
by the Senate. Oh, man.
Back in February.
Okay, we're going to take a quick music break here, and we'll be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on WFT, Corporate Free Community Radio. Please call in with your pledge, and what's the number, Bob?
217-359-9338, or go online to our website, weft.org, and click on the Support WEFT button on there.
Okay, we'll be right back. Okay, that was Ann Feeney, National Healthcare Now was the name of the song, and we got some more underwriting announcements, Bob?
Yes. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the Illinois Education Association Union. The Illinois Education Association's mission is to effect excellence and equity in public education and to be the advocacy organization for all public education employees. So thanks to those folks. And since we're in Pledge Drive, we can also mention, too, that if you want to underwrite this program or any of the programs here at WEFT, any of the other public affairs programs, any of the music programs and whatnot, email our station manager at weft.org, and we can help you out. Or if you specifically want to underwrite this program, give us a call or get hold of Dave or myself, and we can help you out there to become an underwriter of this program.
Yes, indeed. And again, I mean, WFT is a really underutilized resource, you know, an asset in this community. And, you know, you will not hear public affairs programming like ours or others on corporate radio. Neither will you hear the musical genres, most of the musical genres being played on WFT. That is just not heard on corporate radio. I got a couple of public service announcements here today. From 2 to 4 p.m. at Chenny Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon in Urbana, a panel discussion of how can we help low-wage workers, featuring Ricky Baldwin of SEIU Local 73, Belden Fields, Emeritus Professor of Political Science, University of Illinois, Pat Simpson, Emeritus Professor of Industrial Relations, Loyola University Chicago. For generations, Americans shared a tacit understanding that if you worked hard, a livable income and basic securities would be yours. That promise has been broken. Today, more than 30 million men and women in this country work in jobs that pay poverty wages and provide few, if any, benefits. In this panel, several aspects of the low-wage issue will be addressed. Number one, myths about low-wage workers. Number two, problems with measuring income and adequacy and the history of a local living wage campaign. And three, current social justice efforts on behalf of low-wage workers, including the fight for $15 an hour. Also, next Saturday, April 19th, Central Illinois Jobs with Justice will be sponsoring a meeting, which will be also at the Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, at 9:30 a.m. in Urbana. The meeting will present two members of Northern Illinois Jobs with Justice, Mary Shesgreen and John Lash, who have been instrumental in getting support in the Illinois legislature for several bills that were curtail and limit the anti-union corporate charter school agenda. They'll also discuss how they were able to organize successful community support and resistance to corporate charter schools in Northern Illinois. Central Illinois has not yet been affected by corporate charter schools, but anti-union corporate special interests are still expanding in Illinois, and we need to know what to do when they begin to infiltrate our community and threaten public schools, as well as the standards of unionized teachers and education support staff. We encourage rank-and-file teachers and support staff members, as well as members of the community, to attend this crucial meeting. Again, that's next Saturday, 9:30 a.m. at Chenny Murray Foundation, corner of Matthews and Oregon, in Urbana. So, Bob, any last words before we play some ending
I was going to mention something, expanding on your mention about the Chicago unions.
Yes.
And Rahm Emanuel's move up there to cut the pensions and stuff like that. And I kind of had a story about that same thing. It says that the unions are divided. It actually says that 28 out of the 31 unions support the bill, which is quite incredible. The three unions that staunchly oppose the bill are the Chicago Teachers Union, Ask Me Council 31, and the Illinois Nurses Association. So those are the only three unions that stood up and opposed Rahm Emanuel's plan. Although,
oh, that's a whole other topic of a whole program. Basically, the corporate unionism. The corporate union, and this is discussed a lot at Labor Notes. Corporate unionism is not getting the goods for working people. We need to get more rank and file control of our unions, and we need to start going, standing together and fighting together, and not having our leaders sell us out and make these sweetheart deals with these politicians, or and or afraid to piss off the Democratic Party. I mean, I'm sorry, but you know what? Push is coming to shove here, folks, and you know, we the old rules just don't apply anymore. I mean, they've basically, corporate America and the Democratic Party had thrown these out the window a long time ago. And, you know, we can't, you know, if they're not going to play by the rules, why should we? I mean, this is class war. I mean, I'm not going to put it in any kind of sweet watered down terms. It's exactly what it is. We've been losing the war now for well over a decade, and it's time we start fighting back. And these unions, I mean, the members, that's another topic, because unfortunately the laws work against members trying to take control in their unions, but it's got to be tried. And I mean, we got to do it. I mean, we got to get back control of our unions before we can even think about getting control of our government and our society back. But anyway, I'll climb down from my soapbox there for a moment. Bob, any last words?
I got one more thing here. The Boneyard Arts Festival is going on this weekend. WEFT, besides being in our pledge drive, is participating in the Boneyard Arts Festival by hosting pieces by Kuldeepa Vartek Mehta. And Miss Mehta describes her installation called Portraits of Me, Myself, and My Soul as works that represent my journey inwards. They are experiments with shadows and movement created by the play of light on wires, paper, and wood. The visual effects symbolize the inner happenings in each of us. And that Portraits of Me, Myself, and My Soul is on display right now, today, from 11 a.m. until 3 p.m. yet today. And we're at 113 North Market Street in downtown Champaign. Come by and check out this fascinating exhibit. And if you're here, you can certainly make your pledge donation to WEFT.
That sounds really interesting. I might have to stick around for that after the show.
Yeah, a little bit. I noticed the lights are out there in the Great Hall, so you can't see our vast display of CDs out there, but there are some shadows and things moving around out there. So,
Bob, do you know where we're at right now in the pledge drive as far as where we're at?
Dave Vitani, station manager, said that we were approaching $10,000 the other day. So,
Okay, so we're not quite halfway there.
Yeah.
So, folks, please, please call in. It doesn't have to be today, right now, but sometime when you get a chance, anything is appreciated. I mean, even if you can't afford $40 for a year, I mean, anything, every little bit helps. And, to help keep us on the air.
As people are saying, I heard it said pretty well, this is simply a pledge to help us out. If you don't have the money today, we'll send you a bill. You know, if you got $40 and you want to pay it in $10 installments under a four-month program, they can work that out with you here. You know, if you go online to our website, you can put it on your credit card through PayPal and stuff. That's secure. And, you can spread those payments out. Even a payment of $120, which would get you one of Robert McChesney's books there, is really only $10 per month. So that's very little to help us stay on the air and to continue to get this quality information and music that you get here.
Indeed.